This is 8. This is entitled Helping Parents, Part 2. We'll look further at some things that we can do to help parents. We'll also have an interview that I think will be helpful, an interview with a man who has been a high school teacher and guidance counselor for the last 18 or 19 years. But first, let's continue to look a little bit at helping the parents. We have to be sure that we help the parents accept their calling. And I would speak about it as a calling. It seems to add a little importance when you talk about it being a divine calling of God. We've already mentioned that they are called to righteousness, Hebrews 12:14. We've also mentioned, but I want to emphasize, that God has called his children to do what is right, not just to do what gets results. We read from Proverbs 19:21 and from Proverbs 21:30 and 31. And again, that was one of the things that really helped me as a parent, to realize that God has called me to righteousness, not to just get results. We could all perhaps buy our children, especially if we had enough money. We could say, if you won't drink, I will get you this car. Or if you won't drink, I will do this or that for you. But that's not the way that we should be appealing to them. We should appeal to them based on what is right and what God expects of them and of us. And that should be enough. Now, I mentioned earlier we do use leverage sometimes in a negative sense of discipline. But in a positive sense, we appeal to them based on the knowledge of God that's within them, their profession of Christ, if they profess to be a Christian, and just basically what is right, the right thing to do, and that there's value in doing what's right. But that closely ties in to this third aspect of helping them accept their calling, which is that God has called parents to be models. Philippians 2:5-11, Jesus is our model. Also note Matthew 7:12. There we are told to do to others what we would have them do to us. And as models, that is the essence of modeling, being what we want other people to be. But let's talk a moment, too, on how we can help parents keep their focus. We want to help them keep their focus first on the kingdom of God, Matthew 6:33, to seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. That should be primary in their focus, is on God. Secondly, we want to help them focus on their own Christian character. We might refer them to Matthew 5:1-10 of the Beatitudes, that they are to focus on being the right people. Third, we want to focus on the whole family, not just the problem team. Sometimes we can have terrible problems with the other children because they were neglected. Perhaps the oldest or one of the children, doesn't matter which one, is acting out a great deal, and all the attention is put on that child and the others are neglected. Well, then we have more than one teen who's a problem. We have several others. They may not act like problems right now, but they may show it in other ways in their lives later on. So we want to be sure we continue to focus on the whole family. A good illustration of this is how even if one member of the family is ill and requires a great deal of attention, let's say the mother is ill and the father is having to care for her often. In order to help the children be raised correctly and help them enjoy life, there would be times that the father would have to get someone else to come in and watch the mother so that he could spend time with the children, taking them places, going out with them, playing with them, reading with them, doing all the things that they would hope a father would do in spite of the mother's illness. It's the same way with a problem team. Sometimes we have to get them taken care of, get them in a safe place or a sitter or whatever is appropriate at that point, and do things with the other children. We want to be sure they don't hog all of the attention. I hope I've not belabored that too much. And then fourth, we want to help them focus on the marital relationship. Refer you to Genesis 2:24, that the primary family relationship is not the parents to the children, but the parent to the parent. That is the one that is spoken of in such glowing terms as being of one flesh and leaving and cleaving to one another. That is the primary relationship. If that relationship is solid, then the relationship with the children is going to have a much better chance of succeeding. Next, I would like to focus for a moment more on this idea of relinquishment, which I introduced in the last lesson and read a quote by Dr. John White. Let me lay out in perhaps a little more clear terms what I'm talking about in terms of relinquishment. The idea of relinquishment is simply giving over, giving something over to someone else. And when we relinquish our children to God, we give them over to Him to deal with. It's not that we ignore any of our own responsibilities, but we give over our rights, that or things we may consider our rights, as we'll get to in just a moment. But basically, relinquishment is a giving over to someone else. Secondly, relinquishment and parental responsibility are not mutually exclusive. A parent can still be responsible, do the right things, and yet have given that child over to the Lord. For instance, it's right for me to feed my children. Now, when I give the child over to God, I don't expect God to supernaturally place food in front of the child. I still accept my responsibility to feed my child. But whether or not my child eats, or what they do with that food and the nourishment they get from that food, I've given over to God, so that God is to lead and to deal with that child. If that child is nourished by what I feed them, and then that child goes out and commits a crime, the crime is not my fault. I have given that child over to the Lord, and the Lord will deal with him or her in his own way. Relinquishment means giving up, as I've said. And I'd like to give you now 8 different aspects of what it is we're giving up. We're giving up first the right to be proud. We all want to be proud of our children. But when we give this child over to God, we give up our right to be proud in our own parenting skills. Secondly, we give up the right to uninterrupted enjoyment of our children. We all want to enjoy our children. We think often that it's a right to enjoy our children. But in giving up our children, we give up this right to uninterrupted enjoyment. We sacrifice by realizing that there are going to be problems sometimes that interrupt our joy. Third, we give up the right to possess our children as though they were property. We no longer consider our children property, ours to do with as we want, whenever we want. Fourth, we give up the right of repayment for anything that we have done for our children. We give up. What we mean is that the children don't owe us for being their parents all these many years. They don't have to do anything, and we expect nothing in return for our parenting. Fifth, we give up the right to uninterrupted tranquility. Anyone who has not understood that already, having younger children, will soon understand it when they become teenagers. We give up that right to uninterrupted tranquility. Sixth, we give up the right to respectability in the community. Sometimes our children may disappoint us, and more than that, they may embarrass us. And we sure want to be careful about that embarrassment thing. If the parents have recognized that they have been embarrassed by their children, they need to admit it to themselves and to you, the counselor, but help them not to spend a lot of time dealing with that issue with their children. It just makes their children feel like property, and it shows the pride of the parents in the negative sense. Number 7, we give up the right of protecting our children from the consequences of their actions. As they grow up, we protect them from the consequences of their actions all the time. They start to touch the stove when we've told them not to, and we rush over and stop them again. We don't let them burn their hands, but we have to realize now that the children are young adults that we can't be there all the time and we can't protect them from all the consequences. A less dramatic example of this than much of what you'll be facing is the parent. I remember we were talking in a group one time about letting our children see the consequences of their actions. And everybody was in agreement, this one mother in particular. Well, the next week I saw this mother, and she began telling me how her son had come to her the night before a big party at school, a party that was a formal, and said, "Oh, by the way, I need you to get me a tux and a corsage for my date tomorrow night." Well, of course, mother, "Why did you wait so late?" "Well, I don't know. I didn't know." And so what did the mother do, the one who had agreed that we need to let children see the consequences of their actions? She spent a frantic Friday driving to another city in order to rent a tux for her son and then to order this corsage and get it made all in time for his date that evening. My suggestion was that she should have said, "You know, if I'm going to do something like that for you, I really need a couple of weeks' notice. Since it's so late, I won't be able to do this for you. You'll have to take care of it yourself." And if that young man was embarrassed by either having to cancel his date because he had no tux or having to wear a suit instead of a tux, those are the kinds of consequences we need to begin to let our adolescents see. One of the things that I do with my children in terms of consequences is, in that case, if they are very repentant and they have recognized the error of their ways and they know that they should have been on top of it, I most likely would go and help them find that tux, etc. But if their attitude is such that I've done something wrong and not getting it done for them, then I'm more likely to be stubborn and to say, "Well, you just figure it out yourself. And next time, if you want me to help, give me this much notice." Number eight, I will say, is giving over the managerial rights of our children's lives. We do manage their lives as little children and as they grow up. Once they are young adults, we need to give over management to them. Sort of ties in with what I was just saying about letting the child find their own tux and make their own arrangements for dates, etc. If they want the car washed, get the car washed. If they want it waxed, they need to get it waxed. Letting them do the things that we used to do for them. Things concerning school as well. If they want to do their homework, they need to do their homework. If they need some help, let them ask. But don't put yourself as a parent in a position to always be telling them, "Did you do your homework? Is it done? Why is it not done? Let me see it." We need to be even willing to let them make bad grades and not get into the best school because of it. More about that in a few minutes. We need to realize, too, that relinquishment ends the power game. The power game of feeling guilty when our children do or do not do things. Relinquishment, giving them over, ends that power game for us. We need to also recognize and help parents recognize how God relinquishes His children. That God says, "You know, here's everything that you need. Here's what I want you to do. Now you go and do it." Now, if they don't do it, God allows them to fail. We have to let one another fail. We have to let our children fail. And then finally, relinquishment is directly related to the disciplined life of the parent. 2 Timothy 1:7 says that God did not give you a spirit of timidity, but a spirit of power, of love, and of self-control. The disciplined life of the parent shows that they have given this child over to the Lord, and it shows to the child this is the sort of life to be lived. Often we don't relinquish our rights over to God, because either we think we can do a better job, or we don't know God well enough to know that He will do a good job, or we don't relinquish because we are just so scattered in our lives, we only respond to crises, and we haven't planned and worked at being a parent well enough. But if we're disciplined, we'll plan ahead, and we'll do the right things. Now, let me remind you once more of the counselor's role here, and that is the role to A, give options, B, encourage conformity with Scripture, C, be clear about what can happen with each course that they might choose with their children, and D, respect the decision made by the adult. We may have to disagree with them, but we have to be respectful that they are the ones making those decisions. What I would like to do now is to give you a bit of an interview I did with my brother, Mark Hines, who is a guidance counselor for First Baptist Academy High School in Dallas, Texas. Mark is in his 20th year of association with the academy. He's in his 11th year as guidance counselor. And I've asked him some questions about some of the things we've been talking about to get from his perspective as a private school guidance counselor and teacher, the sort of wisdom that he's had to draw upon through the years and can offer to us now. Mark, the people that will be listening to this tape are going to be involved in counseling adolescents themselves. And I was wondering, do you see any differences in counseling teenagers from a Christian school versus teenagers from a public school?
Bill, probably the distinction that I'm aware of from talking to my counterparts in public schools is the degree of parental support that I enjoy. Our counseling with our young people in the Christian school setting is done from a standpoint of a real team concept, that we're in a team situation with the parents, whether there be two parents involved, one parent involved, but the parents are normally totally supportive of what we are trying to do, that is, share the same goals that we have for their children. So we enjoy great teamwork. We also can counsel from the standpoint of very singular goals in terms of the Lord's involvement in their life, whether the teenagers are real excited about it or kind of excited about it. At least they know where we are going to be coming from. So they are, if they're in our school, they know that's what we want for their lives, that we want God's best for their lives. So that would be a little bit different. We don't have to slip up on them. We don't have to apologize for the standpoint of that we're coming from in terms of things of the Lord. So they expect that, and that's what they get when they come to us for counseling.
Is it a requirement for teenagers that go to your school that their parents be involved at some level?
It's a requirement in that it's from at whatever point they enter, whether they are interviewed and enter as in the upper grades, or if they've been, as we say, homegrown all the way since elementary, they know it's expected of them. They are encouraged at every turn to be involved, but there's no set activity they have to be involved in, or so to say it's required, I'd say expected to be a better word for it.
So there's even almost peer pressure among parents, that they know that other parents expect them to be involved with their own children.
Yeah, it's the thing to do, but we realize that the teenagers are with us, oftentimes at great sacrifice to the families, and so that requires a lot of our families have two incomes. In fact, most of them do, and so there's some give and take, and they are oftentimes the parental involvement is perhaps most often in terms of watching their students perform athletically or dramatically or in the band or whatever they're doing. Sometimes that's a limit to parental involvement, but yet we have probably in recent years we've enjoyed more parent volunteers even during the day. This usually is moms, but sometimes it's fathers or granddads or grandmothers involved in just day-to-day activities running the school, helping out as volunteers. And that's very visible, and that's meaningful to the kids that their relatives care enough to be involved. And some kids express that and are real appreciative. Other kids aren't as expressive about that. But you know, my experience has been that deep inside they know, and they file that away within themselves, that their family cares enough to be involved.
What would you say are some of the issues common to almost every adolescent you counsel?
Oh, I think the common issues that come up that they talk to me in both positive ways and also negative ways in terms of it causing problems is their relationships with their peers. That is a source of joy and a source of frustration for a lot of the students I see, how they're perceived by their friends, how many friends they have, what kind of friends they have. That's always on their minds. Also, their relationships with their parents and their families, siblings, perhaps too. It's important to them. It comes up more from the negative side. If things are not going well, then it's an issue. If things go well in their families, sometimes they take it for granted. Sometimes they don't mention it if things are going well. But if things are going poorly, it frequently comes up.
I suppose that if you're seeing a person, it's most often because they feel they have a problem that they need to discuss, or they've been sent to you because they have a problem that someone else wants them to discuss.
Yes, that's true. Sometimes they're referred to me because either they've expressed specifically that they have a problem in that area, or they might be acting out I'd say academically slipping up. And oftentimes it's because of something going on at home or something going on in their personal lives. And experienced teachers, their various keys that they will look for, and one of the things is their academic performance. Oftentimes, is shows something going on beneath the surface. Yes, we do have some very nurturing teachers that pick up on just the smallest hint, and oftentimes uncover some things that kids really do want to talk about. And so my teachers probably in the school are some of my sources of most of my referrals. That and the parents themselves will call me and say, there's something going on, we don't know what, or there's something going on, and we know what it is, and we want them to talk to somebody besides us about it.
As they get a little older, perhaps toward college age, or perhaps even first year in college, what are some of the common issues? Are there issues that begin to surface at that point that did not surface before then?
I think, Bill, one thing that I see a lot, as they get older, they are starting to face consequences to previous actions. And this, just the process of going to college, they are held accountable for things such as their grades, the classes they chose to take, their extracurricular activities. Now they have people that are outside their family, outside their school, another school or another institution that is saying, okay, we see this about you, and this tells us this and this and this about you, and they are making decisions on that teenager based on what that teenager has been doing in terms of college acceptance or scholarships or whatever. And some of these young people, this is the first time they've ever had been in that situation where someone that isn't close to them, doesn't see them on a day-to-day basis, is making a decision about them. And sometimes it's good news because some of these teenagers have taken care of business and have good resumes and they've been consistent. But some of them have ignored the warnings or the encouragements they've had all along the way, and now they're having to, in essence, pay up. And that's a sad thing for some of them. And some of them, it's the first time they've ever had to do that. And so that's a issue that I see a lot on the negative side. On the positive side, an issue we see as they approach graduation or as they get off into college, they are, and this is frequent, this isn't rare, they frequently come back and give me the input that they are so glad now for all the people in their lives that took time to hold them accountable, to teach them things that they at the time did not think were very important. But now they look back and experience has shown them that, hey, if I hadn't been able to do this skill or didn't have this quality built into my life, I would be sunk now that I'm in college or off on my own or have a job or whatever.
I know that in my work, one of the hardest calls to make is when a teenager needs to be put out of the home because they are being terribly disobedient, perhaps being a bad influence on the rest of the family. And what, in your opinion, are some reasons that a parent might have for having to send their teenager away from home before the age of 18?